Democracy Now, 8 to 8:59 a.m. Thank you so much for joining us. Please consider becoming a sustaining member for as little as $10 a month. Call our pledge line right now at 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. You can make a contribution of any amount. The sustaining member is $10 a month, but you could become a regular first-time subscriber for $25. Or you could make a contribution of $100 or $500, whatever is comfortable for you, whatever you can do to help support WBAI. That number is 212-209-2950. Right now it's 9 a.m. And coming up next, Covert Action Bulletin over WBAI.
Covert Action. Welcome to Covert Action Bulletin, the official radio program and podcast of Covert Action Magazine, where we've been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. Our program today is brought to you by way of WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. I'm your host, Chris Garaffa.
And I'm your host, Rachel Hu, and we're very happy to be here with you on Covert Action Bulletin, recorded late on Tuesday, August 9th. So we have so many stories to get into today, Chris, and we're going to be very happy to be joined by two guests to talk more about the attack on libraries around the country by the far right. I mean, whether they're hosting drag queen storytime events for kids, featuring books on LGBTQ topics, or just simply having honest books about bodies, sex, and puberty on the shelves, extremists are coming after libraries and librarians. I mean, you see it all over the internet, and you really do see these attacks intensifying. I mean, just this past weekend, neo-Nazi group NSC 131 forced a library in Boston Seaport area to cancel its drag queen story hour. This comes a week after community protests in nearby Jamaica Plain countering the same exact group. I mean, this is just crazy to see the fascism continue and the particular focus they have on libraries. I'm curious to get into. In addition, also, I wanted to mention the library in Jamestown, Michigan, which will shut down after residents voted to defund it. A campaign of fear was waged by the right, claiming that librarians were, quote unquote, grooming kids with LGBTQ themed books. I mean, this is not the first time in U.S. history that libraries have come under attack for ideas that threaten either the status quo or vocal and voracious right-wing movement. But really, we're going to talk with these librarians to talk more about this. The right wing is absolutely vicious, and we will see how it all unfolds later.
Yeah, Rachel, I'm really looking forward to having that conversation later in this episode, and I hope people stick around for that. But first, Marjorie Taylor Greene tweeted something very interesting. Defund the FBI. And just before that, an upside down American flag, meaning, you know, in country in distress. And this is not because, you know, Republicans are voting against, you know, like cutting the cost of insulin or, you know, because we're destroying the planet, but it's because the FBI, quote, raided Trump's home in Mar-a-Lago, Florida on Monday afternoon. Trump himself made an announcement, of course, not on Twitter himself because he can't be there anymore, but word quickly spread. They even broke into his safe, he says. I mean, I think this has been so interesting to watch, and I want to get your thoughts on the actual events themselves, but this has been so interesting to watch for me because, first of all, it was Trump who appointed Chris Wray as the director of the FBI, and Chris Wray would have absolutely had been involved at the highest levels in making this happen. But also, I mean, MTG, defund the FBI. I mean, and she's not the only one, right? Like, all of them, all of the right wing are just like, wow, the FBI has gone woke. I mean,
what?
No, but at the same time, right, we have like liberal groups and like liberal commentators saying like, go FBI, yay FBI. And I'm like, how are you celebrating the FBI at this moment? Like, I mean, regardless of like what happened at Mar-a-Lago yesterday, right? We're looking at the like an organization and the FBI that is responsible for assassinations. It is responsible for spying on political activists. It is responsible for so much harm to people in this country that just because they raided the, you know, home of the former president, you know, who you don't like, doesn't mean that we should be cheering the FBI on.
No, absolutely. Chris, there's so many things. I mean, first, Marjorie Taylor Greene, I'm just going to leave that there. Like, I really don't even know what you're supposed to do with that. Defund the FBI. I'm just like, so you're mad. You're mad that the FBI is going after Trump. I mean, we're talking like a whole year plus after any situation that would be whatever. It's just there's so many things. I mean, it's not about January 6th, but it really does blow my mind that this is the time they want to make that stand. Like, yeah, you know, the country in distress, not the fact that there are, you know, literally like justices sitting on the Supreme Court who are essentially a dictatorship determining our fate and completely essentially decimating U.S. democracy. That's not what's going on here. No, like the FBI is raiding Trump's house. I mean, even to mention that too, like that there's like people on the liberal side of things that are going, yeah, FBI is our liberator. They're going after Trump. I mean, like just because somebody's attacking your enemy does not mean that they are your friend. I mean, the FBI is the same body that's responsible for COINTELPRO. I mean, the same body that decimated the left, that made us, to put us in the position that we are in today. I mean, that was the FBI, like the complete destruction of not just the Black Panther Party, but all of the movements that came out of the 60s and 70s were dismantled specifically by this investigative bureau. So I just can't understand how in any way, shape or form we can see the FBI as some liberator of the people. But I think to my analysis on that, though, Chris, is that I just think people are so desperate. They so desperately want to see any level of justice done in any way, shape or form, that any indication from the status quo or the ruling class that there's going to be movement in terms of pushing the actual prosecution of Trump forward on any level. I just think people want it so badly that they're willing to just be ecstatic that of all people, the FBI is the one carrying it out. And like in other things too, I saw, which were just really important to the story to me, is that this is all coming in the wake of the fact that it's very clear that Trump has every intention of running a 2024 campaign. I mean, Pence might even be running, like opposing Trump, which is going to be like, what even is that? Like, I'm not even going to touch that, but that's like literally what we're looking at 2024. So, I mean, they searched his home looking for documents. And so apparently Trump had all of these classified documents that are not supposed to leave literally the White House. They're not supposed to leave even outside of that, just federal property on any level. And they're at a private residence, his Mar-a-Lago residence in Florida. And so I really don't even know if criminal charges could come out of this, but it is a federal crime. I mean, it is a federal crime to have these documents in his possession. So I'm not sure what you think, but that's where I'm at. I just think people are just so desperate to see something happen.
Oh, people are definitely desperate to see something happen. I agree. But at the same time, we've got, you know, and I'm just going to come out and say it, these grifters on the so-called left. I mean, an entire podcast celebrating Robert Mueller. I mean, it's called Mueller, She Wrote. Who, like, no. I'm sorry, they were, you know, the and this milieu were celebrating not just this, you know, raid on Trump, but also with like almost the same level of energy, a raid on the African People's Socialist Party last week, which, you know, we haven't had a chance really to talk about on this show, but this is a black socialist group, an internationalist, anti-imperialist group that was raided by the FBI in response, you know, or as part of a subpoena against a Russian national who will never face charges, right? Like, this guy lives in Russia, will never come to the U.S., will never face charges. So it was a black-led socialist, internationalist, anti-imperialist group that was attacked. I mean, they were cheering that on as well, which just shows like a political bankruptcy on their part. But there's also, I mean, I think there's the fact that, yeah, Trump is going to be running. I mean, there's almost no way he's not going to run. I would love to see him and Pence go at it, though. I'm just saying, like,
just as a petty thought. Yep.
Just as a petty thought. I would love to see that debate, because that would, I think it would just be, it would give us a lot of material for sure. But No, he's definitely going to be running. He still has this base, right, who looks up to him, who believes in all of, you know, the racist, awful things he says. And they're the ones, you know, really responding to this and responding, you know, in all seriousness to people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and others who go on Twitter and say, you know, defund the FBI. And they don't say that for the same reason that progressives say defund the police, you know, because they're an oppressive institution. They say defund the FBI. Of course, because they think that this particular instance of the FBI is opposing them and not, you know, black folks in the United States, for example, or radicals or extremists. And that's really what this comes down to. I think, too, the thing we have to keep in mind as we look towards, I was going to say look forward to, but I was going to just say look towards a Trump announcement, is the fact that Alex Jones' lawyer accidentally sent all his text messages to the opposing counsel.
I want to read it. I want to read it so bad, Chris.
January 6th committee is going to get their hands on them. So I am super interested to see, too, what Alex Jones's text messages are going to say about his relationship with Trump and in particular the QAnon movement and, you know, all of those who were involved in January 6th.
No, I really want to. Don't you know Alex Jones's lawyer randomly, like just on a personal level, you somehow know him? Like, what is this man like? I'm so curious, Chris.
I mean, I can read you his own words. His own words are, I'm an Islamophobe, and I believe that Islam and Western liberalism don't mix. I represent women, even though I don't believe them just because of their gender. That is from Norm Pattis, one of Alex Jones's lawyers. He's from Connecticut. I'm in New Haven, Connecticut. That's where he's from. I've met him a number of times. He used to do events against the drug war. He defended Occupy New Haven in court when we were involved in that movement and trying to not get kicked off the green because we were raising serious political messages that the city, and in particular Yale University, which is right there, did not want displayed. But he also says, I enjoy provocative for the sake of provocation. So really, this is a guy who wants money, he wants attention. But the way I put it, if it walks like a racist, if it talks like a racist, if it makes a point of defending racists in court, then it's a racist. So yeah, I do know Norm Pattis, unfortunately entirely too familiar with his body of work.
Oh my God, Chris, that's wild. I mean, you know, it just kind of reminds me, I'm thinking about this as you're saying, like this interesting kind of connection between this weird libertarian edgelord way of thinking and talking in terms of people that find themselves on the left and then ultimately end up on the right. Like, I think that there's something really there. Like Marjorie Taylor Greene, like it is funny to me that she would say defund the FBI, but like it isn't really funny. Like it's crazy because the reason why she's doing it, I can't tell if it's meant to be cheeky, like in the sense of like, haha, I'm like a funny liberal now saying defund something, or if it's really meant to like appeal to the fact that people legitimately like were interested in and vibing with the fact that we should defund the police. Like it kind of scares me, like the way in which the right wing does co-opt the language of the left. Like that is something that is very concerning. Like one of the things that I saw, which was crazy to me, was that there were these people outside of Mar-a-Lago, like Trump's like most fervent fan base, I guess, came out in support of him. They were like protesting the fact that like there was a raid happening, and they were bringing out all these signs, and all the signs were saying different things. But like one of the signs was like, Democrats are fascist. And I was like, really? I mean, I was just genuinely like, I'm not going to sit here and defend Democrats on any level, but I will say like the idea that Democrats are closer to fascism than the reactionary politics of Trump is just, that isn't accurate. It isn't accurate. But it is an interesting perspective that somebody would bring. Why? You know, and that's because the right wing has been very astute, very adept at co-opting all of the ideas and thoughts of the left and really pushing them in their own narratives. I mean, I feel like, to be honest, the right wing talks about the horrors of the Holocaust and like all of this kind of like ridiculous, I guess the language of anti-fascism, but also making it fascist. I don't know how to really pull all that together, Chris, but I've been thinking about that after I saw those signs. I was like, really? Like, this is what you're going to culminate at. This is what you're going to demand alongside a Trump 2024 sign. And these are the same people that co-sign these kind of right-wing groups that we're going to talk about later with the libraries. But it's just really, it's really stunning to me, the lack of consciousness around this. And it just makes me say, like, we really need to be raising working class consciousness with everybody, whether you're from the middle of the road, maybe you're more conservative, whatever it is, like really needing to understand what fascism is and what the right wing is, because I just don't think that we have that kind of consciousness really being built if there's that kind of confusion. But I don't know what you think, Chris. I'm just kind of blown away by that.
No, without a doubt. I mean, like the idea that the right wing is using that kind of language, I mean, it's certainly nothing new, right? It, like, they've been going at it for a while, and I've seen them, you know, they have adapted and they have moved in some ways. I mean, if you remember back in the day, like we can go, you know, back 12, you know, almost, you know, 14 years now, Obama was somehow a Muslim, atheist, fascist, socialist, communist.
Fascist, socialist, communist.
Yes. You know, and so, you know, I mean, I'm not surprised to see people saying, oh, we are, you know, these are, you know, Democrat, communist, fascists. You know, it's really throwing terms around without meaning in many ways. But it's the things that, you know, you're supposed to be afraid of, right? You're supposed to be afraid of Muslims. You're supposed to be afraid of atheists, of communists, of fascists, depending on the flavor of the day. So I'm not surprised, but I think we do need really powerful voices, you know, in the media, you know, in our own media, in people's media, because we know, you know, that the right wing media, the mainstream media will be really just completely distorting anything that is said for its own benefit. I mean, case in point, you know, just to talk about this for a couple minutes, Roger Waters of Pink Floyd, but also a fantastic activist, was on CNN recently and did an interview, and they completely took it out of context. Did you see this interview that he did?
Yeah, I did, Chris. I just can't. I mean, like, many things. I mean, Roger Waters, I'm just going to say, is the real MVP. Like, I will give it to him. Like, he's out here on Long Island specifically. Like, it will be six people defending Shinnecock land. And then Roger Waters, like, is there in the Hamptons because he's a rich guy. He has a house in the Hamptons. He's out there and he's demanding, like, the treaties of the Shinnecock be respected. And it only becomes news because Roger Waters is there. It's like literally like five of us. And then Roger Waters, like, what? Like, gotta give it to him.
I have seen him in concert. I have not seen him personally, but I have seen him in concert actually on Long Island. I, you know, saw him a couple times out there. You know, he is also outspoken for Palestine and one of the very few musicians. And I think, you know, he owes it to his popularity that, you know, he hasn't really been, I guess, so-called canceled for that, even though he brings it into his shows very proudly into his shows that he is pro-Palestine. But I want to play this clip from this CNN interview that he recently did.
Are you an equal opportunity offender on this tour? Here's why I ask. I remember the last tour. Of course, I came and watched very much, you know, about Trump. And in the current show, you've got a montage of war criminals, according to you, and a picture apparently of President Biden on the screen. And it says, just getting started. What's that all about?
President Joe Biden?
Yeah.
Well, he's fueling the fire in the Ukraine, for a start. That is a huge crime. Why won't the United States of America encourage Zelensky, the president, to negotiate, obviating the need for this horrific, horrendous war killing...
You're blaming...
We don't know how many Ukrainians...
But you're blaming the party that got invaded. Come on, you've got it reversed.
So that was what CNN aired, but thanks to a friend of the show, Kevin Gostula, for pointing this out on Twitter, here's the actual interview that CNN did.
President Joe Biden?
Yeah.
Well, he's fueling the fire in the Ukraine, for a start. That is a huge crime. Why won't the United States of America encourage Zelensky, or whatever his name is, the president, to negotiate... and to explain why, when he stood on the platform of ratifying the Minsk agreements, which he did when he was elected by 73% of the Ukrainian population that was left able to vote, after that, somebody either whispered in his ear or he completely changed his mind about making peace in the Donbas and about solidifying the Minsk agreements and making peace with their Russian neighbors and obviating the need for this horrific, horrendous war killing...
You're blaming...
We don't know how many Ukrainians...
But you're blaming the party that got invaded. Come on, you've got it reversed.
Wow. So an entire, basically, history lesson that CNN will never give, of course, just completely cut out of that response. I mean, it is just so disingenuous and straight up offensive for CNN to really misrepresent what Roger Waters and, you know, honestly, so many anti-imperialists and anti-war activists have been saying about this exact conflict. I mean, he is not wrong.
He's not wrong. He's literally correct. And I think that what's really frustrating to me about this, or not surprising, but like, I don't even know if I would say frustrating, but the one thing here that I really want to focus on is the fact that when we're talking about the issue of Ukraine, like, we really need to be clear, like, the United States has done nothing but fuel the flames of fire, have done nothing but since the very beginning provoke Russia. I mean, we're in this situation because of NATO and because of the United States. And Roger Waters didn't even go that far. He wasn't even going that far. That wasn't the kind of statement that he was even making. He was just making a very basic statement, which is, why is he not encouraging peace? I mean, are we really in a situation in this country where anyone's speaking out saying, you know what, maybe we should encourage peace? Maybe peace is a good idea? Like, how is that not a mainstream concept? How have we gotten so far right that the idea of even peace itself is alarming and scary, or, oh my God, this person is out of his mind? I mean, it kind of reminds me too about the whole Amnesty International debacle last week, about how Amnesty International released this press release over the Ukrainian military's fighting tactics and some of the different war crimes that were being used. And it's not to say, of course, that like Russia hasn't done a variety of things that are questionable nonetheless. I mean, this is war. This is complicated. But Amnesty International is pointing out something that's very important in this moment in time. And they have been since not only attacked. I mean, there was recently an article in the New York Times coming for them. There's an article in a couple of other mainstream publications I've seen as well, coming for Amnesty International, but also they've had a very particular type of Russiagate, you know, foaming at the mouth. Like, Archie, are you guys, you know, like, they're standing for President Putin? Are you behind? Is Putin paying you? Like, I was just like really surprised. I mean, Amnesty International as an organization is not by any stretch of the imagination left. It's not by any stretch of the imagination the international defender of human rights. And so for them to actually put this out and put it forward and have them be so vicious attacked, it reminds me of how Roger Waters is being viciously attacked. It's just like anything, even slightly in the direction outside of what the mainstream narrative is that's being curated by the White House, by the way, which is very important. It's not curated by everyday people. The conversations that are coming in the mainstream media are all really hook, line, and sinker what the press releases of the White House are telling people to say. I mean, there's so-called inside sources. That's always what it is. But I think it's really important that we see how tiny how the Overton window has shifted so much and how tiny the acceptable thought is here. And I think Roger Waters is being absolutely misrepresented. It's a damn shame, honestly.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Rachel. I mean, props to Roger Waters for using his platform, using his popularity, using, you know, everything he's got to still continue knowing that this is going to happen, because he knows this has happened in the past and it will continue to happen in the future to him and to others. But props to him for doing that. But also, you know, really, we need to keep up this anti-imperialist movement. We need to keep up this, you know, this anti-war movement to say that, you know what? No, we're not saying, you know, one thing or another here. We're about, you know, the Russian system or the Ukrainian system. What we're saying is effectively in the U.S. that the U.S. should not be engaging in this conflict, that the U.S. should not be provoking this conflict with its so-called diplomacy, with its money, with its weapons, and all of that. That is exactly the thing that, you know, we need to be saying here in the U.S. is that the U.S. is responsible for this conflict. And just like Roger Waters is saying, there is so much more to the history that needs to be exposed.
Yeah, and they cut it out. And I mean, this makes me think too, like, I also appreciate Roger Waters using his platform. And I think a lot about, like, what could be the moment right now in terms of what artists could be saying in general. Like, it's just like not just about war and not just about anti-imperialism, but even outside of that, just about racism, about police brutality, about women's rights, about LGBTQ rights. I mean, there really is a moment now where artists should be using their platform. They should be speaking out. They should be saying with everything that they have, fighting for a different world and what they believe in. I mean, it really is crazy to me that this is the kind of reaction and response that happens when somebody does say something. And I think that, to me, like what you're saying, Chris, is so true. Like what we need to be fighting for, what we need to be pushing for. And I also kind of want to bring in here this as well. I mean, he had also mentioned questioning what's going on with the Uyghurs in China. And I think that that's something, it's a whole nother conversation in terms of exactly and specifically what he got into. But I think it is important that there, that in a society, in a democracy, frankly, if you have a democracy, there's a healthy level of difference of opinions. I mean, like, that's real. Like, you bring that forward, but it's just not allowed in the United States. And it is really stunning to me after talking with people, like recently being in Cuba and then talking with other folks that I know in China, there's a very, very vibrant disagreements, actually, in countries with democracies, different perspectives, different thoughts, people who criticize the government openly, who love the government openly, and also have their own criticisms, but also support what the government is doing. I mean, there's a tons of nuances in conversation and positions. And in the U.S., we are given propaganda that is so profoundly just devoid of any level of nuance. And I think that that's a, it's just something that we need to be really pushing back against, all things considered.
It certainly does. And I think I'll say this. You know, I remember during the anti-war movement in the 2000s when the Dixie Chicks, you know, being from Texas, spoke out against the Iraq War and against George W. Bush. It was something about, you know, being ashamed to also be from Texas. They were widely panned. I mean, even when Bruce Springsteen, who, you know, older white guy, but writes some solid, like, working class music, when you listen to his music, when he wrote 41 Shots about the police murder of Amadou Diallo, he was attacked by even his best fans. He was booed at concerts. I mean, the NYPD said that they wouldn't give him, you know, protection outside concert venues and things like that. I mean, real, real challenges, you know, just for speaking out as a musician. Rachel, I think we should keep the show moving on. I'm really looking forward to our next conversation. But first, you're listening to Covert Action Bulletin, the official show and podcast of Covert Action Magazine, where we've been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. Brought to you by way of WBAI 99.5 FM. I am not afraid. Stay tuned.
Action Bulletin, brought to you by way of WBAI Radio in New York. Covert Action has been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. I'm your host, Rachel Hu.
And I'm your co-host, Chris Garaffa.
And we're so happy to be here with you, and we are happy to be back. We have so much to get into. Either way, we want to talk about the fact that libraries across the country have been under attack by the far right. I mean, whether they're hosting drag queen story time events for kids featuring books on LGBTQ topics, or just simply having honest books about, and conversations about body, sex, and puberty, extremists are coming after librarians. And actually, just this past weekend, we had mentioned this earlier, but I want to bring it back up. Neo-Nazi group NSC 131 actually forced a library in Boston's Seaport area to cancel its drag queen story hour, much like what has been happening to libraries across the country. Either way, we have so much to get into here. We're very happy to be joined now by Anna Santoyo, who's an activist and library page in Chicago, as well as Stephen Lane, who's an activist and reference archivist in Indiana. Welcome to the show, Anna and Stephen.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so I kind of want to get into it. Like, I know, like Stephen, you're on the ground. You're the one who's out here, especially in Indiana. I have so much curiosity around what this is like. I mean, we mentioned this attack on the library in Boston. We mentioned also people voting in Michigan to shut down their own library. And for folks who didn't catch that earlier in Jamestown, Michigan. The library is going to be shut down after residents voted to defund it because they are afraid of librarians, quote unquote, grooming kids with LGBTQ themed books. Has this been something that's been coming up in your library? And generally, what have you been seeing across the country, in particular around the attacks on libraries by the right? And just like, what is it like dealing with that on a day-to-day basis?
So yeah, I used to work for the Indianapolis Public Library right here in Indianapolis, Indiana. And I used to work in the children's department. And in 2017, I was a part of bringing in the first drag queen story time that we did for the Indianapolis Public Library. And I remember in 2017 going to my supervisor and her supervisor and, you know, security and just saying, we'll need to talk about security, you know, around this event. And I just remember how surprised they were, you know, when I brought that up, because I don't think they realized, you know, just how homophobic people can be in libraries. However, you know, despite that being said, you know, we plan for the worst and hope for the best. And we had the greatest turnout for that first drag queen story time. And our drag queens were actually school teachers by day and drag queens by night. So it worked out, you know, really well. They were great with the kids. The kids just loved it. The parents loved it. You know, I've done story time so much that, you know, at a certain point, when I'm reading to the kids, I can see when the parents are just so bored and their eyes glaze over. Yet with the drag queens, you know, the kids and the parents were just so into it that I knew that this was an event that we had to keep doing. And the pushback was very minimal that first year in 2017. It was just, you know, we got a few phone calls. Actually, it was just like people calling in saying, no drag queens in the library. And they would just hang up and, you know, do weird stuff like that. But you do see that it is ramping up all over the country. Not so much here in Indianapolis, I would say. We did have a new library branch open on the south side in West Perry. And they're the library staff did an LGBTQ display. And that one, someone made a social media post against it. And this was like probably in 2020 or so, around there. But the comments in Facebook were overwhelmingly positive. So that, you know, like we're not really experiencing what's happening all over the country just yet. However, you know, there's always that chance that it's coming here. It's just a matter of time.
That's really touches me what you said about the parents, you know, really getting engaged, right? You know, not just the kids, but the parents getting engaged, because libraries, I mean, I have loved libraries since I was a kid. You know, there's one next to my school growing up. We would go after school, just like before going home. I mean, it's just so important to me. And I feel like, you know, having a community engaged in a library is like one of the key pieces of it. But Anna, what's your experience been like?
Yeah, no, first I'll say, Stephen, your library drag queen story hour seems awesome. but yeah, when we are, you know, like engaging with our story times and, you know, getting people in, that's like one of the things, right? They have this counter patrons that are coming in, like all these things. And drag queen story times are extremely popular. And them becoming targets of the far right, it speaks to, you know, today's library attacks are founded on the same principles of library attacks of the 1950s. While book bans and book burnings were talked about against public libraries for carrying any communist literature, they actually cited that, right? Those same forces today are trying to shutter libraries. And we heard about the recent one in Michigan that they're actually citing LGBTQ plus literature in their library as a reason for defunding the libraries, right? I think like they got that defund slogan wrong. and I think it's just, you know, for them trying to like shutter libraries for carrying books, affirming people's gender, marital status, stories that should live on our shelves. People should read them, and there's books that do matter. So,
yeah, you know, I mean, it's interesting too. Like we were talking earlier about Marjorie Taylor Greene getting defund wrong as well. Defund the FBI, apparently, because the FBI went into raided Trump's house. But either way, I mean, it is interesting to me. I really appreciate you bringing up this history because I think it's super important. And a separate side note too, I don't know what you think on this, Chris, but I often feel like libraries in the U.S. are they're underappreciated, underrated, and not seen really as what they are. And I think in so many ways, they're a great example of what public funding can do. And I think that for some reason, you know, there's all this anti-communism in the United States. It's like the unofficial religion of the U.S., just endless anti-communism, like, oh, socialism is terrible, bureaucracy is terrible, look what happens with our public dollars. And like, you know, in some ways, like, look at libraries and say, look what happens with our public dollars. I mean, you can go to your local library and get 3D printing for free. Like, I mean, that's crazy. Like, access to knowledge is a human right. And I think that libraries keep that open, and they keep it open with the tax dollars that we pay. And so I do think in some ways it's like a tiny little microcosm of what's possible when we reimagine the world in a different way. And that, so it's not surprising to me then, Anna, as you bring that in, that of course they've been a target of this kind of anti-communist campaigns for such a long time. And I know, Chris, you had a clip you were interested in bringing in here too. I don't know when we want to do that, but either way, I just think there really is such a rich history here.
Yeah, I found this clip very interestingly, Anna, since you were talking about the history of President Eisenhower in 1953 and talking about libraries and book burnings. And I'm going to play this, but then I want to talk about why it was so striking to me and how it made me feel about what we're seeing today.
Don't join the book burners. Don't think you're going to conceal faults by concealing evidence that they ever existed. Don't be afraid to go in your library and read every book. As long as any document does not offend our own ideas and of decency, that should be the only censorship. How will we defeat communism unless we know what it is, what it teaches, and why does it have such an appeal for men? Why are so many people swearing allegiance to it? It's almost a religion, albeit one of the nether regions.
I mean, had me in the first half, right? Like, saying, you know, don't join the book burners, but because we're going to use that to fight communism. But, I mean, as you started to mention, this is in the context of, you know, of a time when the U.S. realized it could not and did not eradicate the USSR in World War II. And, of course, there were mass debates happening in U.S. politics about whether or not libraries should be not just offering for circulation, but having access to news like Soviet publications, newsletters, things like that. You could get publications from anywhere else in the world in most major city libraries, but having Pravda or, you know, another Russian newspaper in the 1950s was cause for some people to, you know, say the library should be shut down, for books to be burned. So Eisenhower saying don't join the book burners was actually not saying, like, you know, this pro-library thing. It was just saying we're going to use libraries as a tool against the communists, which is just so wild to me that, like, that full clip seems to never get any press. But of course we know why, and of course libraries do suffer, you know, at the hands of, you know, whatever the political whim of the, you know, of the system is, and like whatever is happening in society. I mean, you know, I remember after the Patriot Act was passed in 2001, right after 9/11, librarians were some of the first people standing up for civil liberties, because part of the Patriot Act was going to make librarians say, you know, hand over your records, your book records about what you took out, what computers you used, and things like that, you know, to the FBI. And they were starting to put up signs saying, if this sign is here, we haven't been visited by the FBI yet, because they couldn't talk about it. Never would have thought, right, that librarians would have had to be activists and civil libertarians. But Stephen, how do you see, like, that the role, you know, as a library worker, you know, a professional there, but also as somebody who has to be, like, actively considering, you know, civil liberties and the defense of just basic rights in that job?
Yeah, I think you really hit it on the head when you said that, you know, libraries are subject to the political whims of the state. You know, we always like to think of our libraries as like the cornerstone of democracy, as these neutral spaces. But honestly, and that's probably what you would mostly see on the patron side, because you're dealing with mostly library workers. But being on the worker side, you notice that it is a very political space. It is very much a contested space. And, you know, the people who run your libraries at the top, the administrators, the executives, and the board of trustees, that's where we need to start paying attention, because they're making decisions about our libraries that really have an effect. And if the right is organizing themselves to go to these library board meetings, they can really influence these board of trustees, because a lot of them on the board, especially at the Indianapolis Public Library Board of Trustees — I don't work there anymore, so I can say this about them. Whereas, you know, other library workers who work there might not say this, but they have political agendas that are very personal. One, the board president is a judge and who has aspirations of becoming a federal judge someday. So, of course, he's going to, you know, it makes him look good being on the public library board. You know, it's definitely political gains for him. So they're going to do, you know, what the public that's showing up at tells them to do, 9 times out of 10. So if that's a right-wing group coming in telling them to censor books, and can bring in a campaign that makes them look bad, it could happen. It really can. So yeah, the library is a very much a political space. It's not neutral. It never has been a neutral space. I moved up in, you know, I work in archives now, so we collect historical records of our libraries and our library institutions. And, you know, I have records that go back to the 1920s about how they tried to segregate our library system, the library workers, the librarians and executives and board of trustees were working hard to segregate libraries, the Indianapolis Public Library System. So yeah, if we're not paying attention, you know, these things can happen all over the country.
Yeah, I want to second that, actually. Stephen, I think you like put that really well, about libraries not being neutral space, because it's something that in library school, they actually really try to drill that they are neutral spaces. And there's so many, you know, it's a dominated white field, but we're there and we are, you know, like changing that. And I think an example also that kind of like corresponds with these attacks is the example of this like anti-critical race theory actions. You know, here in Chicago, there was a massive settlement and victory that high schools had to teach the history of the John Burge torture settlement. And this is a history of the Chicago Police Department, and our high schools have to carry this out in our libraries as well. So the police and their families like actually held like protests outside of police stations, libraries, to demand that, you know, that these be like optional to get into being able to learn about these things, and that the parents had to sign off on all these things to prevent any anti-police sentiment. If we're not challenging this and challenging all of these attacks about access of information being neutral, that's as if library workers themselves and school workers themselves aren't, you know, living under these, you know, racist conditions in their own workplaces. It's just kind of crazy to say that, as libraries do act as so much more than just a places of books.
Yeah, I mean, knowledge is political, like, period. Knowledge is political. And I think it's kind of mind-boggling to me that there's this desire to make it neutral, because whenever you push for something being neutral, it ends up always caving to the right. I mean, that's just how this works. And I really appreciate you bringing up critical race theory. I mean, I think the critical race theory, the pushback against drag, the drag story time hours, as well as the pushback in the local school boards. I mean, this is like to me, a multiple pronged approach of the right wing to be able to really push forward a truly reactionary agenda on the local level. Like, I mean, that's the way that I see this. I mean, the critical race theory stuff to begin with, critical race theory as a concept, it isn't even real. I mean, like, what they're calling critical race theory is learning about slavery. And that's not, the word critical race theory comes from a very particular author of a very particular book and a very particular college course that has no application whatsoever in the mainstream. But it's a buzzword that they've invented in their own way to really demonize the idea that learning about racism in America will somehow be detrimental to the people of the United States. And I think that, to me, it's a really interesting point, because it's about whipping up parents for fear. And it makes sense to me in relationship to specifically the attack on libraries for LGBTQ issues. Like, I saw this TikTok, which was crazy, which is like this librarian who every day had to come into the store or come into the shop. And I don't know the word, this store, shop, library, whatever the word it is. They had to come into their workplace and they saw all these different books that would be turned around every single time, every single morning. They'd have to turn them right back around because it's different books that are either gender affirming books or just about, you know, kids, normal young kids who are experiencing life as young LGBTQ people. Like, these books are really about, and this movement that we've seen for LGBTQ rights is really about, it's humanizing people. It's humanizing the struggle. It's giving especially young children access to understand themselves and to think about themselves in a way that isn't hateful and miserable, in the way that homophobia forces that on people in society, transphobia forces that on people in society. And this is a movement to change that. And of course, that's why the right wing is going after it, because it's about scaring parents. It's about, you're coming after the children, you're grooming the kids. It's about sex. It's about sexuality. It's about all these evil things. I mean, it kind of reminds me a little bit of like the satanic panic of like the 80s and the 90s, because it's the same thing. They understand that if they get into the minds of parents on a very hyper local level, they have the ability to do a lot of damage by making sure that they turn things like school boards. They're spending millions of dollars, by the way. This is not a small campaign. They're spending millions of dollars to turn local school boards towards this kind of right wing agenda and to get different people elected that have the same anti-critical race theory, quote unquote, agenda, the same anti-LGBTQ agenda that we see attacking all of our public institutions. But I did want to go back to this, and I'm curious, Chris, too, if you want to hop in here on this. Like, as we were talking, I was thinking a lot about the fact that back in the day, libraries served as this main point of information for people. When you don't have Google, when you don't have search engines at your fingertips, what is on the shelves is what you have access to. And so it is a very disturbing conversation about the idea that they want to limit, back in the day, like this Eisenhower clip that we were listening to, that we wanted to limit access to things like the Communist Manifesto, or limit access to things like newspapers around the world. I mean, that is about changing the way that people think and feel. And today that's done by algorithms. But I think nonetheless, like, the control of information is at the heart of this, and it's really terrifying.
Well, it's the control of information, but also the control of access to information, too. Because if you shut down your library, then many people who have no access to the internet other than the library can't do it. I actually recently, here in New Haven, where our library is not, you know, necessarily under attack. I mean, it could always use more money, and actually is having a bit of a budget issue right now. You know, y'all might appreciate this. You know, we tried to just call and say, hey, can we reserve this space on a Saturday for this event? And they said, well, we can do that, but we might have to cancel on you last minute if we don't have the staffing that day, because they've been suffering so much with budget cuts. And, you know, just as a place for communities to come together as well to get information, it was going to be for a community organizing meeting for people to talk about some stuff that's been happening in the local New Haven community. And just to hear that, and the worker who told me that on the phone, she was heartbroken to even have to say it, because she knows we've done this a million times and so have so many other people. So I think, Rachel, to your point, you know, if people can't access Wi-Fi, if they can't have a safe community space, maybe, you know, with air conditioning or heat, or just literally just four walls and a roof somewhere they can sit and get a cup of coffee or talk to other folks, a social worker, just get some help. I mean, because libraries are so much more than just the books, you know, that are on the shelf, or even the computers that are on the desks. It is really one of the last places of community, you know, that I think we have. And I'm really curious, you know, how is that access, like that overall access, not just to the book knowledge, I guess we could say. And I guess we'll start out with the case of Chicago. What does that look like, you know, for y'all?
Yeah, I mean, like you were saying, and it's actually why I went into like wanting to work at a library, was because it was like the only free place that I could take my baby for a story time, and then learning so much more that the programs that the library does offer. In my library, we right now are signing up families for public schools. People can register to vote at my library. There's overdose medication that people can get, emergency overdose medication that people can get at my library. And Chicago has extreme weather, and libraries are all designated as heating and cooling spaces for the neighborhoods. So yes, so much I think we have to say is that it being the last free, affordable, you know, you would talk about access, like that's what we're talking about for families, for youth in Chicago, because there's nowhere for youth to really go. Their community centers are shutting down. I mean, especially like during the pandemic, we've seen just so many things change, and libraries are not separate from that. And I think we're always trying to make the best out of like the situation with the pandemic. Having safe places for children right now, I think, is so important, and advocating for our communities that need these things and more. We shouldn't have to go to these like budget meetings and speak to why we need to keep A, B, and C. These things should be rights for families. We should have all of these things. As you mentioned earlier, Rachel, that these are examples of good way for public funds, how they should be used is for the people.
Yeah, I just want to echo what Anna said, you know, about my mentor. She runs the Center for Black Literature and Culture at Indy Public Library. She calls libraries that third place, you know, so you're that place that isn't work or isn't home. It's this place that you can go and get on the internet, meet friends, do all kinds of different activities, catch a program on, learn a new skill. You know, there's so many opportunities that the public library offers that it, yeah, it's very unfortunate that the funding just seems to always go over towards the police, you know, while every other budget in the city gets cut and slashed. We just had our budget for 2023 released yesterday, and the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department is getting the largest budget cut of our budget that they've ever gotten in their history. So they're not being defunded. Money is not being reallocated to support, you know, such a great service like the public library. Like, what better way to, you know, give teens something to do than, you know, have programming geared towards teens through the public library? Or, you know, and it's hard to do that when those public library budgets keep getting slashed the way they are.
As we get towards the end, and I appreciate both of you joining us here, I want to look at the struggle, you know, because wherever there's attack, right, there is struggle and there is response. And so looking at the situation in Jamestown in Michigan, right, where that they voted to defund effectively their library. It's about 10,000 people. The majority is households with children. It's very much like a Leave It to Beaver type situation, from my understanding, right? Like, vast majority white, like 98% white. Almost 85% of households are married couples living together. 50% have children under the age of 18 living with them, and all of that. You know, but then you go to like Boston, you go to Jamaica Plain, where this fascist group, NSC 131, has been attacking, you know, drag queen story hour events. You know, Jamaica Plain certainly being gentrified without a doubt, but has a long history as a black neighborhood, you know, certainly not a wealthy place, you know, but there's struggle going on in all of these places. And I want to see how you, from kind of where you're at, right, where you're at and kind of inside these systems, but also as organizers, as activists, you know, what do you see as the connection here between these struggles against these direct attacks? I mean, I'm saying the physical attacks, right, but also the defund, so to say, attacks, the more the attacks, the more that come kind of in the form of a city council vote or something like that.
It just seems that these right-wing groups are being emboldened. You see all these different politicians, you know, finally saying the quiet part out loud as well. So I think it's really emboldening these people who are white supremacists, as well as, you know, I feel like white supremacy, like homophobia and transphobia, is tied up into white supremacy in a lot of ways, because, you know, they're trying to tell you, you know, majority white people trying to tell you, like, this is what's acceptable and this is what's not. And the public library offering a breadth of to represent a lot of different points of views. Not all of them good, of course, like, you know, having your public library have books on the shelf about gay conversion therapy, I don't think needs to go in a nonfiction section or interfiled with the LGBTQ collection. Yeah, so they're not going after those books. They're going after the books that affirm LGBTQ people, that affirm someone who is experiencing racism, you know, that really reflect them, that people that can go into the public library and check out materials where they can see themselves reflected in that material.
Stephen, you said it. Libraries are the best. Librarians are the best. This is such important work that you two are doing. And for all the librarians and pages and workers who are out there, thank you as well. We've been joined today by Anna Santoyo, an activist and library page in Chicago, and Stephen Lane, an activist and a reference archivist in Indiana. Thank you both again.
Well, either way, you've been listening to Covert Action Bulletin. I'm your host, Rachel Hu.
And I'm your host, Chris Scaraffa. Covert Action Bulletin is the official show of Covert Action Magazine and is brought to you by way of WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio in New York. If you missed any of our episodes, you can subscribe to our podcasts on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you can find podcasts by searching for Covert Action Bulletin or listen on your station's archive. So, we're all out of time today. Thanks for listening to Covert Action.
Covert Action.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
Pencil.
Okay, this is Joe Franklin broadcasting on radio station WBAI.
It's 99.5% all natural and preservative free, WBAI FM in New York.
I love this radio station.
Remember, the whole reason New York City housing, NYCHA housing, was built the way it was Corbusier understood that if you did not have light coming in every window and if every room did not have air and light, people could not thrive. That was the whole reason for getting rid of the tenements that go with it.
Maureen Coates, environmental lawyer with Planet A Strategies. Hi, I'm Michael G. Haskins, host of Living for the City on WBAI 99.5 FM Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Every week, myself and senior producer Jillian Jonas take an in-depth look at the city of New York as it is developing right before our very eyes. We bring on grassroots organizations fighting to have their voices heard in how the community in which they live will grow and prosper into the future. So tune in to Living for the City Wednesdays at 11 a.m. over listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
WBAI accepts snowmobiles. If you have a snowmobile, we want it. We also want any extra cars, trucks, SUVs, RVs, boats, and more. Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling. Some like to skip the costs of repairing, while others just enjoy the good feelings of giving back to their community. But no matter your reason, donating a vehicle to WBAI is a great idea. And it's easy. Here's how it works. Simply call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or give online at WBAI.org/donate-your-car. Our vehicle donor support team will arrange your free pickup. When the driver arrives to tow away your great gift, you'll receive a donation receipt. Vehicle donations have the potential to drive hundreds and sometimes even thousands of dollars to WBAI. Call 866-WBAI-CAR or visit WBAI.org/donate-your-car.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
WBAI, WBAI.
We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Living for the City coming up next at 11 o'clock. Right after that, the Gary Null Show at noon. But speaking of next, coming up is Project Censored.